Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Shelley Wade. And today we are talking about the exciting topic of a special group of animals that have changed the lives of Alaskans through their work as therapy, service, or police dogs. We're going to learn a lot about the difference of those types of dogs. And on the phone with me, I have some great guests today, is Carolyn Stone. And Carolyn is a certified trainer from Alaska Assistance Dogs. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Shelley. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And in the studio with me is Officer Mark Haywood, and he is with the Anchorage Police Department Canine Unit. And welcome, and thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
We have to say a very, very special thank you to Officer Haywood because he would normally be sleeping right now. I think he got off duty at 6 o'clock, and so we're very thankful for his being here today. And then joining us later, we'll have Donna Erickson, who is mom to Logan Erickson, a young autistic man who has a service dog in Unalakleet. So she'll be calling in here soon. So I want to again thank everyone for being here today. And then I also want to do a special thank you to Carol and Dodd Shea, who are the founders and trainers from Alaska Assistance Dogs that we were hoping would join us today. But they are down in Seward graduating or celebrating the graduation of a young woman that has a service dog that's really helped her successfully complete training at the Alaska Vocational and Technical Education Center in Seward. So that's pretty exciting for them. And I'm going to talk a little bit later about the opportunity I had to spend with them at Walmart and some of the service dogs there. So for listeners, we invite you to call in and share your stories. Email us your questions or comments about dogs that have helped you or helped a friend, whether it was part of their job or not. So in Anchorage, you can call in at 550-8433, outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752, or you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So I wanted to just start first with telling folks a little bit about how the idea for the story came about for me. And that was when an email came across my desk about some Anchorage police dogs, and specifically dogs at the airport that had received a special accommodation. And I've got a story here from March 19th, and we've got to have this posted up on our website, actually, at alaskapublic.org. And I thought it was pretty moving that in March of this year, these particular dogs and their handlers received a special accommodation. And at the end of the week, it says the evaluators went on to say that never before had they written accommodations for handlers, but felt compelled to do so this time. He said he went on to say that both organizations have an outstanding training program in place and completely understand and perform canine training to superb levels of expertise. And he was talking about the TSA National Canine Program and then the Anchorage Airport Group. So that was the idea and kind of how the thought sparked for talking about assistance dogs and service dogs. And so I really wanted to start actually with you, Carolyn. And one of the first things you've taught me over the last couple of days in our chats together is just really, what are the differences? What are we talking about when we say service dog or assistance dog or even service animal? Can you help us understand that a little bit better?
Sure. The term service dog is actually a legally defined term that refers to a dog that is individually trained to perform a task for a person with a disability. And it's very common that people get many of the terms mixed up. People in the industry don't have standardization, so there are a lot of misnomers, but the term service dog is the only one that has that legal definition. And so that is the one term that should be used in a standardized way, I suppose.
Okay. So really, the service dog has, you said, a very specific technical or legal definition.
Yes, that's correct. And the law that was updated in March of last year, the Americans with Disabilities Act, also used to refer to service animals. And now with that update in March of last year, they only acknowledge service dogs as the only breed of animal that can be a service animal, with some exceptions of grandfathering in some animals that already were service animals.
Okay.
So moving forward, we're only talking about service dogs.
So Officer Haywood, where do, maybe you know the answer to this, and Carolyn, where do police dogs fall in? So is there an umbrella term that kind of catches all dogs that provide some level of assistance to people, or?
Well, police dogs, you know, even though we, or police departments around the country use them for different tasks, I mean, primarily here in Anchorage, they're used for building searches, tracking, and of course narcotic searches, and that's our scope. I mean, that's what we're looking at. I mean, occasionally we do get called for kind of a search and rescue operation where we're looking for the lost child that's, you know, been missing from home, or the Alzheimer's patient or something like that. So for us, you know, we use the term PSD, which is an acronym for police service dog. And, you know, that's kind of our role is, you know, our dogs are out there performing these tasks as a tool for our patrol officers to, you know, help them and assist them in doing these other tasks in apprehension and or helping somebody, you know, to locate them. So that's kind of our scope as a service dog.
So police service dogs. Okay, so now we're kind of hearing there's police service dogs. And then, Carolyn, maybe you can explain for us a little bit more what other kinds of service dogs are there?
I think probably the umbrella term that you're looking for would be working dog.
Okay.
Because dogs have many different jobs. The service dog category would include dogs such as guide dogs that assist people with blindness, hearing dogs that assist people with hearing, with deafness or hearing issues. There's a bunch of other dogs. There's dogs for PTSD, there's seizure alert dogs, diabetic alert dogs, mobility dogs. Those would all fall under the category of service dogs.
So there's also dogs that work with folks that have autism. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes, that would be another service dog.
So we have on the line, too, I wanted to welcome to the show Donna Erickson. Hi, Donna.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can hear you really well. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here. Donna, we introduced you just a little bit at the beginning of the program. But maybe you can share for us your story and Logan's story about having a service dog.
Okay. We live in Unalakleet on the west coast of Alaska below Nome in a village. And my husband and I have five sons, and our youngest son, Logan, who's 12 years old this year, is autistic. He's on the end of the autism spectrum, pretty severe, but he can't talk and he has a lot of issues, and we had a really difficult life with him for many years until we received a gift of an autism service dog. Our dog's name is Juke.
Okay, and so you said that you received a gift of Duke, and how did that happen for you guys? It sounded like it took quite a while, and you maybe even had some help of some friends that are famous Alaskans along the way.
We did. We were really fortunate to have, we have a good friend, Dee Dee Johnro, who's an Iditarod musher. She spearheaded the whole project of getting a service dog for our son. It cost a tremendous amount of money, so the Iditarod race, the Iditarod Trail Committee stepped behind her and had many of the top mushers raise money in the 2009 race to raise $15,000, half of the amount for the dog, by running for Logan, and people donated by the mile, and the money was raised rather quickly with an auction at the Iditarod banquet, and the other matching $15,000 was donated by the service dog company where we got Juke in Ohio, called Four Paws for Ability. And through the Iditarod all of the recognition through it. The Iditarod, Alaska Airlines did all our travel and Pin Air. Everything was, it was really a gift, and having a service dog really changed our lives.
So I want to hear a little bit more from you, Donna, about exactly how the service dog Duke, how Duke has changed the life of your life and, of course, Logan's life. But maybe before we do that, I wonder, Carolyn, if you could talk just a little bit more about, because I think people might be curious about, you know, what kinds of dogs are we talking about? So the, you know, what are there specific breeds that, that really do make good service dogs?
Yes, typically golden retrievers, labs, and poodles and mixes of those three make, or they have a better success rate of making a good service dog. The main thing that you want in a service dog is an unobtrusive helpmate. And so while any breed potentially would have some individuals that would make a good service dog, those breeds have many individuals, and there's a higher success rate with those breeds.
And so, which might be really different than Officer Haywood, the types of dogs that make good police dogs. So I think we all are like used to seeing the German Shepherds. And so are there other breeds aside from German Shepherds that make good police dogs?
Well, and when I first came into police work, you know, that was primarily and historically, I think, the breed that everybody perceived as being a police dog. And several years ago, the breed to go to was the Belgian Malinois, and another Belgian sheep herding dog is the Dutch Shepherd, which is basically a Malinois, but brindled. Those are the Shepherd and the Malinois, pretty much the two breeds that you'll find when we go in selection test dogs. Occasionally, we will see, you know, a Bouvier or something else, but primarily it's going to be a Malinois and a Shepherd. They seem to be the most popular breeds.
And what makes them good at that type of work?
Well, both breeds have pros and cons. I've worked both breeds of dogs, or Shepherds and Mals, and not to stereotype, but you know, they have certain characteristics of what we call drives and traits, and certain Shepherds have, commonly they're moderate drive dogs, and there are exceptions. You can get German Shepherds that are on a very extreme intensity, but primarily they're kind of a moderate drive dog, very loyal, very level-headed. We have had oftentimes structural problems with a Shepherd, such as hip dysplasia, so we're talking about the physical aspects, not just the genetic makeup of a dog. Mm-hmm. And then because of their moderate drive, sometimes they have what we'd say is environmental issues, such as slick floors. You know, they don't like to walk on slick floors, stairs, and things of that nature, which we have to kind of evaluate upon selection and deem whether or not we can fix those issues. The Malinois, however, is stereotypically a lot more intense in drive. They have very high prey, very high fight. They have a lot of confidence, which enables them to get through some of the problems the Shepherds may have, such as the floors, heights, unstable surfaces, and things of that nature. Very confident dogs. However, because of their high drives, they are a challenge to harness and obedience and control work. It makes them a challenge sometimes. So, you know, they both have pros and cons.
So there's, I think what Officer Haywood is talking about is there's some, you know, genetic or some instinctual things about the, or traits about these dogs that make them good at what they do. So Donna, what kind of dog does Logan have?
Logan has a golden lab.
Oh, a golden lab. Okay. Well, I'm not going to hide the fact that I'm a big lab fan, so I've got two of them hanging out at my house right now. Can you tell us a little bit more about Duke? And you had said, you mentioned earlier that he's really changed your lives. And can you tell us a little bit more about that? So maybe how things changed or how life was before you had Duke there to help you out.
Okay, first of all, his name is Duke with a J, like jukebox.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Before we had Duke, we did not sleep for many years. Logan suffers from insomnia, And one thing about having a companion service dog with Logan, it keeps him calm. And Juke is trained to sit on Logan when he has a meltdown, when Logan gets overstimulated by sounds or sights or anything, he'll sit on him, and it stops the meltdown, and Logan will stop harming himself. And when we brought our dog home, it was amazing that the first time, we've had him for a year now in October, and we've slept all year. It's really been a big change for us. A second thing that Juke has done for us, he is trained as a tracker. Logan had the problem all of his life in autism. It's called bolting. He'll just run away in the dead winter with no shoes or socks on. We have to keep our doors locked. Juke is trained to track by smelling his trail and finding him. And he has been successful in that several times. He's really take a big weight off of our shoulders, my husband and I. We had a couple instances in the past where the whole town would have to look for Logan. And there have been times when Logan would run into the ocean or the river. And Juke is trained to keep him safe. And a third thing that Juke does is he is with him 24/7. They tether together. Juke is on a harness, and he's tethered to Logan's belt. And he walks him to school and to walk home. He has given Logan independence, and he has given our family freedom.
So he gets Juke gets to go to school with Logan, and it sounds like you said.
Yes, he does.
And so is Juke pretty popular in the community of Unalakleet then?
He's very popular. He's really well loved. We had a school assembly before he came to train the kids not to pet him when he's working. He has his collar, red collar on when he's working, and when we take it off is the only time the kids can pet him.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Hometown Alaska. Today we are talking about really working dogs, and so that could be in any category of therapy dogs or service dogs or police dogs. And my guests on the phone are Carolyn Stone, and she's a certified trainer from Alaska Assistance Dogs. Also on the phone is Donna Erickson, mom to Logan Erickson, and they have Juke, sounds like a great companion service dog that's changed their lives. And then also in the studio with me is Officer Haywood, and he's with the Anchorage Police Department K-9 Unit. If you would like to ask any questions or have any comments, you can call us here in Anchorage at 550-8433. Outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752, or email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And I just wanted to mention there are a couple of websites and resources that we do have up on the website. If you're curious about and would like to learn more about service dogs or working dogs, we have those resources listed on the website. So Donna, I wanted to ask you, because I know you need to go at 2:30 today, and we appreciate so much the time that you're sharing with us. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the training that you received, perhaps. We know that the dogs get a lot of training, but did you also receive some training as an owner of a service dog?
Yes, we did. Our whole family had to fly out to Xenia, Ohio, to the Four Paws for Ability place, and we had 2 weeks of intensive training for 2 weeks on how to care for Juke and to learn all of his commands and to learn how to go tracking with him. And just there were 14 families there, and this was specifically for autism service dogs. And it took 2 weeks, and then we flew home with Juke.
And so your funding to do all of that, you said, Donna, earlier, that you kind of raised those funds through kind of different community efforts to help you not only get Juke, but actually do the training. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, it was all paid for through community fundraisers. A lot of people stepped up. It was mostly the Iditarod Trail Committee that raised a significant amount.
So maybe, Carolyn, you can talk a little bit more then about the training process in general. And so I think it would be interesting to know, you know, so we hear Donna talking about, and then I bet Officer Haywood can share some stories with us, too, about the training that also the officer has to receive, the human has to receive as part of the overall training process. What is the length for training the animals? When does that process start?
Service dogs right now?
Yes.
Yeah. The short answer is it varies, but typically around 18 months to 2 years to train a service dog, and depending on the organization that's doing it, there are a couple different models, but one common model that's used by Canine Companions for Independence and Guide Dogs for the Blind is that the dog lives with a puppy-raising family with CCI, it's 15 months, and with Guide Dogs for the Blind, it's around there. I think it's a little bit less. And then comes in when they're that age and they have been socialized and they have learned some basic commands. They come in to do their advanced training, and that is, with Guide Dogs, anywhere from 2 to 4 months. Very intensive training, so several hours a day. With the service dogs that are more for mobility and other disabilities, it's often 6 to 9 months of advanced training, and that can be oftentimes 1 to 2 hours a day of training for the dogs during those 6 to 9 months.
And then what kind of training? So you also received some pretty intensive training, and can you tell us a little bit about that and that how that links to the work that you're doing today with Alaska Assistance Dogs?
Sure. I have a professional certificate from Bergen University of Canine Studies in service dog training, and what that is it was a 6-week course, full-time. It was very intense and very wonderful. We spent 2 weeks having a similar experience that Donna Erickson just talked about. We were acting as the clients, and we were learning to live and work with a service dog. And then we had 2 weeks where we focused on two things. One was the early puppy training, where we were training 3-week-old puppies, and the advanced training, where we were training the, quote, teenage dogs on their advanced skills. And then we had 2 weeks where we were teaching clients and placing dogs with clients with disabilities. So that was an excellent experience. The course was taught by Bonnie Bergen, who is the woman who founded the mobility dog idea back in the 70s. And she's just a legend and has an amazing wealth of information. And I would definitely recommend that course to anyone interested in service dog training.
So Donna, maybe you could tell us before you have to go, how did you first learn about service dogs as an option for Logan? How did that come up as an idea and you decided to pursue that?
Well, Dee Dee Donro was here in Uncleet in September 1 year at she was speaking, being a motivational speaker for some event, and we happened to have a huge storm, and she was staying at my house, and where we got evacuated off the coast up into the hills, and she had her dog with her, and we noticed that her dog and Logan were attached. We were so amazed that Logan was calm, and she birthed the idea of getting Logan a service dog because of that. Her dog Miyagi was Logan's companion during that time, and I've never seen him not freak out so much because he had that little dog with him, and that birthed the idea of getting a service dog. I had never heard of them until then.
So as you're kind of thinking about your experience, then Donna and Logan's experience and your whole family, do you have any specific advice for folks that are in the same shoes as you, and just in terms of how to start this process and, you know, where you went for your first piece of information. Any advice that you could share for folks that are listening that might be in the same position?
If people are interested in getting a service dog, it takes some sacrifice on the part of the parents, because you have to be able to sacrifice some of your time to take care of the dog, to feed it and let it out. And also, you can Google search. There are many agencies out there that are willing to help, and they guide you through fundraising and the whole process. I know that it's a new thing in Alaska, and I'm really excited that that it's in Alaska. It wasn't available in the state when we pursued this.
Thank you so much, Donna. And I want to just thank you very much for being with us today and for sharing part of Logan's story. And what, there's also a couple of links on our website, alaskapublic.org, where you can read a little bit more. There's different news clips that we've collected and that we're sharing back there with folks if they'd like to learn a little bit more about Logan's story. And then, of course, the resources that Donna's talking about that actually connect you to organizations like Assistance Dogs International and Pet Partners that can provide more information. So we're going to actually take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more with Officer Haywood about the work of police dogs.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Shelley Wade, and today we are talking about a special group of animals that have changed the lives of Alaskans through their work as either service or police or therapy dogs. And I've got on the phone with us certified trainer Carolyn Stone. She's with Alaska Assistance Dogs. And then in the studio with me is Mark Haywood, and Mark is with the Anchorage Police Department Canine Unit. So if you have any comments or questions or want to share your stories about dogs that have impacted your lives as a working dog, you can call us in Anchorage at 550-8433, outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752. Or email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And before we left for the break, we had the great honor of talking with Donna Erickson from Unalakleet, who shared her story about Logan, her son who has autism, who has Juke. It sounds like a pretty wonderful animal that's changed the lives of the Erickson family. So we are happy to have her. So I wanted to talk a little bit more with Officer Haywood about the training that we were just talking about for service dogs, and now we're kind of switching gears to talk about police dogs a little bit more, to hear from you, what kind of training do the dogs receive, and then what kind of training do you receive, and what's that relationship between you and the dogs that you work with?
Okay. I'm one of two trainers. I'm the lead trainer, and myself and Officer Jason Wetzel. Periodically, when there are openings, and I'm talking dog positions, and there's a need of a dog, we fly down to specific kennels located throughout the United States. Right now, we're currently going to a kennel in Pennsylvania, 40 minutes north of Pittsburgh, called Shallow Creek Kennels. We've been going there now for about 4 or 5 years and had a lot of success in purchasing dogs there. When we go there, there are different levels of training that these dogs have before we even look at them. Most, if not all, of these dogs are imported from Europe, first of all. Very few are actually born and bred here in the United States. So these vendors at these kennels will actually import these dogs from the Netherlands, Holland, or Germany, Hungary, places of, over in Europe, and they get these stocks of dogs in every couple of weeks, and then police departments go down and selection test these dogs. Let's say we're looking for one or two dogs. We'll go down there, we get a list, and the list is broken down by breed, sex, age, and the type of training these dogs have. Now, of course, you have to understand, the more training a dog has had, the higher the cost of these dogs. There's a term called green dog, and that's just a universal term for us that means the dog has had very little to no training. This is kind of like your next door neighbor's German Shepherd, if you would, who has been identified to have the right drives and traits that it may take to have a police dog, but generally very young, and that's an issue. You can't get a dog too young, just like what was mentioned earlier. Traditionally, we'd like to get a dog between 18 months and between 4 years of age. Nowadays, we're finding that the dogs are coming over at about a year of age, which is fairly young to start police work. Those green dogs can range, if you were to purchase one of those, we're talking about, $3,000 to $4,000.
Wow.
A pre-trained dog gets the next level, and these dogs have had some substantial training. And can vary, they're between 1 and probably under 3 years of age. And we're talking about $6,000 to $7,000. The final category that we deal with is called a title dog. And these dogs, all that means really is that these dogs have had some kind of certification in a dog sport, which isn't very relevant to us, since sport and police work are pretty different. However, it does mean that the dogs may possess the drives, traits, and some of the tasks they've learned that we could use in police work. Those dogs are usually certified in Schutzen, KMPV, IPO, and these are some of the dog sports around, and they range from anywhere between $9,000 to $11,000. So they may have already had up to 3 years of training before we even purchased these dogs. And when we come back here and bring them back, there's a big long process of selections that we go through. Dogs got to be social. Of course, we got to take these dogs into schools and meet people, things like that. And then they've got to go out and track some, very high risk felon or some of that nature. So these dogs have to be social. They come and live with us. And once they're back here, they undergo a 4 month, an academy for 4 months. At the end of that 4 months of teaching them different tasks, they undergo a certification, which takes an entire 10 hours. And then they're certified to go work the street. Now, of course, understanding, just like with anything else, what we teach them is just the very basic fundamental and foundations of what they learn. They really start to put it all together once they're on the street.
So we have a couple of interested callers. Randy, welcome to Hometown Alaska. You're on the air.
Hi. We have a dog that sniffs out bed bugs. Sort of a interesting thing. She's really good at it, and she also requires a fair amount of training, like police dogs. Not quite as long a training, but she did have to take training classes, and she was certified by the National Entomology Scent Detection Canine Association. So she's passed two tests and won a title back in Maryland here of last year for her abilities.
For bed bugs specifically, huh?
Yes. Yeah, they don't believe in training the dog for multiple things. If you were to train the dog for multiple things, the dog's not able to differentiate what it's finding. So the dogs are trained specifically just to find the bed bugs.
Well,
and they're only trained to find live bugs.
Well, thank you for that comment, Randy. That's really interesting. Carolyn, I wonder if you can share with us a little bit more about how do the service dogs that you work with, how do they get certified? What's that process? And is it something as specific as what Randy just mentioned for, say, working with folks that have autism or working with someone, for example, that has PTSD?
There is not a legal requirement for certification for a service dog, and along the same lines, there's not a legal requirement for identification either. But there is, through Assistance Dogs International and through many organizations that train service dogs, a public access test that's given, which is a test that the human and the dog go through together, and it basically will... there's a series of items that they need tasks that they need to do, and it ensures that the dog is suitable to go out in public, and it's safe for the handler and for the public. And then there are also, you know, some other things that need to be, or other criteria that need to be met, and one is health of the dog and physical and emotional maturity and that sort of thing.
Thank you for your call, Randy. So Officer Haywood, you mentioned, too, that kind of the part of the process Carolyn just mentioned, too, is kind of introduction into the public is an important part. And I think we've seen maybe even over the last 6 months the Anchorage Police Department canine unit in the news because you were introducing, was it a new group of dogs maybe to the school district, to a classroom even?
Yeah, we've currently in the last a year and a half, I replaced a dog that I had just retired, as did the other trainer. We had, in that particular case, that was a three-dog academy, and then I've just finished up a two-dog academy. So within the last year and a half, we've actually put five new teams into the community out of the eight dogs that we have. So that's a pretty big turnover for us. And, I mean, it's very, very important for us to be able to get what we do with these dogs out there. And we do spend, and our handlers spend, an enormous amount of time on their own time during the day, like myself, because we do work odd hours, going into the schools and doing functions and meet and greets. We just had our open house a couple weeks ago at the ConocoPhillips and did a meet and greet there. And it's very, very important to us to get what we do. After all, most of these dogs, people don't realize, is actually purchased through donations from the community. So we like to give back you know, allow the public to come and meet these dogs and to just, you know, get rid of that myth that these are attack dogs and so on and so forth. I mean, most of these dogs will let you rub their belly. You know, they like their little, you know, rubs behind the ears and things of that nature. So, I mean, they're really cool animals.
Great. So we have another caller on the line. Jason, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Hello.
Hi, Jason.
Hi. Well, I originally heard about the service dog program for PTSD a little bit about a year ago, and I've had a miniature pincher for a while, and 4 months ago I got him involved in the program, and he is now in training to be a service dog, and he has made a great difference in my life. I don't know what I'd do without him now, and I think the service dog programs are very well.
Thank you for that comment, Jason. So you had a pet that turned into a service dog, it sounds like.
Yes.
Okay, Carolyn, can you talk a little bit about that? Is that pretty common for folks that have an animal already, a pet, for example, and, you know, it's their beloved pet, that there's an opportunity to train your say, miniature pincher, it sounded like, Jason, you were saying?
Yep.
Is there an opportunity to train maybe breeds that you wouldn't normally think are service dogs?
There absolutely are. Anyone can train their own service dog, and there are service dogs of a wide variety of breeds. It's good to keep in mind that not all dogs will be successful as service dogs, even dogs that have been temperament screened and raised specifically for that purpose. So, It's one of those things where it can be a setup for disappointment if the person's beloved dog does not make it as a service dog, but it can also be a very wonderful situation like Jason's talking about when that person's dog does make it as a service dog.
Well, thank you.
They can do wonderful work.
Yeah, thank you very much for your call, Jason. I think that point that you've just made, Carolyn, makes me ask the question, how does that work? So when a service dog or even a police dog is, you know, coupled with, say, an officer or an owner, for example, what if that relationship doesn't work out, Carolyn? What are the options for folks? So you've gotten a service dog, and it sounds like there's a lot of time and training and, as we've been mentioning, some even funding that goes into this. So what happens if the relationship you know, the two don't get along?
Yeah, the relationship is very important. The bond between the person and the dog is one of the most, basically one of the three important factors in the success of the team. The other would be the temperament of the dog, and then the third would be the health of the dog. And it doesn't always work out. It's work with live animals, humans and dogs, and the match doesn't always work. But there are, what I would tell, you know, the person is to keep looking and to keep at it and to find a dog that will be a perfect match for that person. And then for the dogs that didn't work with that person, that dog may well, you know, one example would be a dog that is a little bit too assertive, and I use that term meaning just their outgoing nature, for a person with a mobility disability, but they may be a perfect match for an able-bodied person with a disability such as PTSD or diabetes, where they have more physical control over the dog, but the dog can still do excellent work for them and assist them in a way that they need. And then there are also other lines of, of work that dogs can go into if they just aren't going to work as a service dog for one person. Oftentimes, they may work wonderfully as a therapy dog that goes out and visits many people and touches lives in a different way, but just as wonderful a way.
That reminds me of what I learned. So I had the opportunity, which was really neat, to hang out with Carol and Dodd Shea at one of our local retail stores on, I believe it was Tuesday afternoon, and some folks with PTSD were working with their service dogs. But someone in that group mentioned that the folks at J-Bear, so the joint joint base at Elmendorf and Richardson, are looking at getting an animal or a service dog to be a facility dog. So for, I guess, a traumatic brain injury clinic. And so it sounds like that's somewhat what you're talking about, Karen, is a dog that would then maybe not be with one owner or one person, but would have the opportunity to meet with lots of people.
Yes, yes. And that is in the works right now. And that's an excellent example of what I'm talking about. Because a facility dog can work with maybe 30 people in one day and do fabulous work with those people and then go home at the end of the night with a family and just have a different lifestyle than a service dog would have. But they can definitely be successful in other areas. Yeah.
So we have another caller on the line. Billy, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Hi. I called in. I have been participating for the last 2 months a owner self-training service dog program. I was injured in a motorcycle accident last year and had to have one of my legs amputated. And so I had a 6-month-old Malamute that I am training to be a mobility dog. And I just wanted to bring up the organization. It's here in Anchorage. They're called Midnight Sun Service Dogs. And it's a really wonderful program because there's a lot of support and camaraderie among the dog owners, all dealing with different issues and training their own dogs. And then as well, because you're doing it yourself, there's not the added expense. It's a purely volunteer organization, so none of the expense is put on to participants. And we do a lot of work, or there are a lot of participants there.
And so you said, Billy, that it was this was your dog that you trained, and it was through Midnight Sun Service Dogs. Is that correct? Billy, are you still there? Sounded like we had kind of a bad connection. But thanks, Billy, if you can still hear us. Thank you for calling in, and thank you for your comments. And we'll get that additional resource posted to our website as well at alaskapublic.org. So if you're just listening or just tuning in, my name is Shelley Wade. This is Hometown Alaska. And today we are talking about animals that have really changed the lives of Alaskans. And through their work as working dogs, either as therapy or service dogs or police dogs. And one of the questions that I got from a lot of folks when I was sharing that this was the story we were going to be talking about today in the conversation, a lot of people said, well, you know, how do dogs that work with folks that have, for example, epilepsy or diabetes, How do they sense that there is something going on with their owner? And I wonder, Carolyn, maybe you can talk about that from the perspective of a service dog, and then maybe Officer Haywood, you can talk about that, you know, just in terms of some of the search and rescue efforts that police dogs do. But Carolyn, can you share for us, like, really especially around epilepsy and diabetes and these other kind of chemical or physical disabilities that folks have, how do the dogs know these things?
Yeah, the short answer is we don't know how a dog determines that a person has an oncoming seizure, or that a person's blood sugar is dropping, or even that a panic attack is about to occur. But there are numerous, you know, incidences of dogs sensing that, and they can sense it with their owner. Once a dog is able to do that, they also have the ability to sense it with people that they've just met. And so even though not every dog is going to be able to sense an oncoming seizure, that sort of thing, when a dog shows that aptitude, the training that's needed for that dog is just that the dog can alert the person that that's about to happen. And then dogs that have been trained to alert, and actually some dogs that haven't been trained to alert but have a relationship with a person and have seen, you know, what happens when a seizure happens and that sort of thing, will often start to do it on their own. So it's one of those things that we don't have the explanation for. We don't know if they're smelling something. We don't know if they're feeling something. Many people think it's scent related, but that doesn't necessarily explain why dogs have alerted humans to oncoming heart attacks and seizures and low blood sugar and high blood sugar. But they can do it, and they can often alert a person before, you know, the medical world would be able to tell a person.
Yeah, so what I hear you saying, Carolyn, is, you know, it's not entirely clear, but there's something that they're sensing, something's going on with their owner, and the dogs aren't particularly trained to do that. It could be someone's pet, and then it's about really training the human to understand when the dog starts to act a certain way. The dog is saying, hey, you, something's going on with you.
Yeah.
You better check in.
Yeah, for example, Dogs for Diabetics in California trains their dogs to alert the human with, it's almost like a dog toy that is always around the dog's neck. And so their task is to pick up that toy and hold it in their mouth. And that only means, you know, the blood sugar is dropping. And so if they come up to them and do any other thing, then they know that they're not alerting them. But if they come up to them and they pick up that toy around their neck, then that's what the dog is telling them.
Wow. So Officer Haywood, how does that work in the police dog world? So you said that, you know, some of the responsibilities of a police dog is to do the search and rescue stuff for even folks that have Alzheimer's and then we've all heard about, like, the narcotics work that police dogs do. And so how are they trained? What is the kind of smell and the sensing training that happens there?
Well, just like with any dog, we go through a screening process or a selection process. We don't have any single-purpose narcotic dogs or detector dogs. And detector dogs can be anything, just like what we're talking about here. If they're scenting a certain thing, the common word that we use is detector. It could be a bomb dog, drug dog, an agricultural dog, a bed bug dog. They're scent detection dogs. For us, we have three dual-purpose dogs or cross-trained dogs that deal with patrol and narcotics. And so they're a dual-purpose dog. And it's like with anything else, you know, when we selection test them, we're looking for certain things. It's like dogs have the drives commonly associated with wanting to go and get a toy, for example, or pick it up and bring it back, retrieve drive, prey drive, all these things. But doesn't necessarily mean that they have the drive to do a prolonged search and a hunt drive. So when we selection test them, we're looking for a dog that's crazy for a toy and those kinds of things. And for scent detection for drugs, it's a game. A little different than what we're talking about here, but, you know, it is. We introduce the four odors of narcotics, and we play with them. They smell these smells, and it's a very positive experience for them. We play hide and seek with these smells, and once they've learned to identify and compartmentalize these smells and identify individually, then we can move on to teaching them and what we call an indication, or sometimes called an alert. The indication for us is an actual sit and a stare, isn't it? That's a passive indication. Then you have the aggressive indication, which you may have seen as the scratching, the biting, and the barking. So for us, we use a passive indication, and you know, you hide the narcotics, and we do a ritual for the dog, because you know, the dog comes in, he doesn't know whether he's going to meet some kids, he's going to find a burglar, he doesn't know if he's going to track or what have you. So we do a ritual which teaches the dogs, when I do these things, you're about to, you know, do a certain task or function, and you know, they know what they're supposed to do. They're looking for those four odors, and when they find it, they go to the point of strongest source, and then they sit and stare at where they believe that source is coming from. And then it's up to us as humans to reward them, and that toy comes out from where they're looking or where that source is. So to the dog, it's a game. I find the source, the toy pops out. It's very simple. But we talked about how dogs can, you know, how they know these things. And it's the same thing in police work. There's a myriad of different philosophies and perspectives on scent detection as far as police work goes, and tracking and other aspects of that. And we're the same way. It's we're not quite sure how they do it. Some dogs have the ability to track or scent better than other dogs. So, you know, there's a lot of things that science is trying to figure out, and we're just trying to play catch up. But one thing's for sure, you talk about the relationship between dog and handler, and it's very, very strong. That bond, when we get those dogs back here, we do something, we take that extra step. When I come back with a dog and we arrive at the airport, the handler meets and meet myself or the trainer with the other dog. And of course, he may have had no other pets before, or even if he has, police work and what we want from that officer as far as education and doing certain things with these dogs is very different. We actually don't have our own facility, so we place these dogs over to animal control in the quarantine section over there. The only person that can have contact with that dog, physically, emotionally, or what have you, is that handler. So for the next 2 weeks, the only person that can bond with that dog is the handler. So what we're trying to do is break down any kind of bond the dog had prior to arriving here, and then expedite the bonding process, so the dog can develop the trust and the bonds that, you know, they then can form a relationship. We then bring the family in and other pets, and then the dog eventually goes home. And like they said, the working relationship between handler and dog is probably the most important thing.
So you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and we're talking about working dogs. And if you still have a burning comment or question that you'd like to share with us, you can call us here in Anchorage at 550-8433, outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752, or email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So we do have a question from Anna that emailed her question in. And her question was, for service dogs who have a lot demanded of them and who have to really focus and suppress some of their doggy nature, how do you maintain quality of life for the dog while ensuring they're doing their job well? So improving the quality of life for the human, or what is a good humane balance, and how do trainers think about that? And Carolyn, maybe that's a question for you with these dogs that are, you know, working 24/7. How does that work? How do you maintain quality of life for the dog?
Yeah, the owner of the dog needs to be aware of that, and they need to be able to provide for the dog's emotional needs as well as their physical needs. It's not humane to have a dog on 24/7. Even a facility dog has to have a family. They have to be able to go home at the end of the night. They have to have downtime. And it's the same for service dogs. So that would, you know, it depends on the person's lifestyle, but most likely would be when the person is at home and not needing their services, that the dog can just be a dog and relax or play or do whatever it is that they do to unwind.
And it sounds, Officer Haywood, like there's the same thing for police dogs. They get their doggy, regular doggy time.
Definitely. When they go home and the handler's done with work, they're just part of the family, you know, and it's a sanctuary, it's a haven for them. We try not to give them any, you know, serious commands. It's a time for them just to relax and recuperate and just, you know, have a stress-free life at that point.
So you have a dog at home right now?
I do.
Okay. Yeah. What kind of dog is that?
He's a Belgian Malinois.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I think many of us are curious about what happens after these dogs retire. So after they've put in a life of work, either as a police dog or another type of service dog, what happens with them? And maybe Officer Haywood, you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. You know, the longevity of a dog depends on that independent, and that depend the dog itself. It could be a structural problem, a health issue, or a motivational issue. But anyway, when they are ready to retire and we've decided that they need to be replaced, the handler always has first option to maintain and keep that dog. After all, you know, it's been his buddy, his partner, his friend for, and a part of the family for probably up to at least 4 years, probably 5 or 6 years. So a lot of time the handlers will choose to keep the dogs. And if they choose to, they then have the option of getting another dog and staying on with the unit. We've never had an issue with handlers and their families coming in with their own dogs, for example. So, you know, some of these dogs may be a little dominant or have a little rank to them, but it always sorts itself out. So, you know, it is a challenge when the handler decides to keep that retired dog and then go get another police dog. So it can be, you know, you got two large dogs in the house in addition to any other little breeds that you may have running around. And it's a challenge, but if the handler doesn't want it, we then try and place the dog within, you know, we have officers that will come forth that are familiar with the dogs and the dog program, but they'll take the dogs themselves. So after all, these dogs, you know, are trained to apprehend and do some pretty serious things. So we want to make sure these dogs have a good home.
Okay. And Carolyn, how about the service dogs that you've worked with? You've got about a minute here before we have to wrap things up. So maybe you can share with us what happens to some of our retired service dog friends.
Yeah, it's very similar. The goal with a service dog is that they have a working life of at least 6 years. And when they retire, they often become the pets of either the person that they worked with or that person's, you know, some member of that person's family. And all reputable organizations would take them back if that was needed and find another excellent home for them. But it's the same. They're retired. They've earned a good life. And they make sure that they have one.
Well, thank you. This has been a fantastic hour. I think as folks can probably hear, there's a lot of territory to cover. So I really want to thank so much my guests, Carolyn Stone, who's a trainer with the Alaska Assistance Dogs, Donna Erickson, who's mom to Logan Erickson, who has the wonderful dog Juke and Unalakleet, and Officer Mark Haywood of the APD K-9 unit. Thank you guys so much. And also I want to thank Carol and Dodd Shea for your contributions. Next week on Hometown Alaska, host Kathleen McCoy and guests will talk about the need for affordable housing in Anchorage and a new study released by municipal planners showing a growing need for compact housing. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can join us on Facebook at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is the Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Speck is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Shelley Wade.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.